Sunday the 13th of June, and we're here in the West End of Glasgow to interview Professor Izzy Metzstein. Is it all right if I call you Izzy?
Absolutely.
Thanks. So, can we start with your arrival here in Scotland? Could you tell us, please, when and where you were born, and did you have a different name at birth? Was this always your name?
My name is Izzy Isabel Metzstein. People think Izzy is a short, but it's actually a German name, or a Germanish name. And Isabel was my second name, and Metzstein obviously was a family name, which isn't, it's handmade, my father made it up. I mean that, because he was originally called Mühlstein. I think he wanted to be more German, perhaps, I don't know. They went to Germany from Poland, well, with Russia, and then came Poland, and then they went to Germany in the early 20s. And I suspect he was trying to be maybe more German.
And where about in Germany? You were born in Germany, Berlin.
Yeah, I was born in Berlin.
And obviously you left to escape the Nazis.
Yeah.
And do you still remember the days in Germany? You were very young when you came here.
I remember quite a lot. I don't know where to start, but I remember clearly the Kristallnacht. And that was quite a curious experience because I've never heard anybody else talking about this in this way. I actually went to school, I was to a Jewish school. We could walk to, it's about 8 minutes walk. And as I was walking there, some children of my class came towards me and said, "Don't go, synagogue, the synagogue and the school were attached to each other. And the synagogue was on fire." So I worried about it, I didn't know why it was on fire. I thought just it was on fire. So I went to look. Now I realise it was probably the most dangerous thing I've ever done in my life. But nobody paid any attention to me. And of course I saw what was happening. I went home. But I saw that the synagogue was burning. The fire spread to the roof of the school. And the fire guard standing by and making sure that none of the non-Jewish property was on fire. And everybody looking at it and enjoying themselves. The non-Jewish, I mean. And I just went back home. It wasn't until later I discovered this had been part of a major attack on the Jewish. There were some big synagogues in Berlin, and they were all burnt out, most of them. But the synagogue was attached to the school.
But
literally, physically attached to it.
You spoke of people watching and enjoying it. Do you think it was a minority who felt like that, or what
no,
do you feel?
I don't think a minority felt like that. I think at that stage, a vast majority of Germans went alongside, maybe not to the same degree of agreement with it, but not enough to make any protest or stay away. No doubt about it. At that stage, Hitler was very popular, and the treatment of Jews was seen as either a very good thing or something that you wouldn't have to worry about. But I would say my only feeling of it is that the Germans as a whole were anti-Semitic to different degrees, obviously. And nothing I've discovered since has changed my mind.
And did you feel foreign at that time because the war was going on? Was it uncomfortable to be German?
No, absolutely not. It was at the one stage, but I was quite young, of course. If I'd been older, it would be probably quite uncomfortable because I found it difficult to distinguish between Germans and Germans, if you know what I mean. But some of them were Germans. I never felt German. My parents had only lived in Berlin maybe about 10 years when I was born. And left. My father died when, of course, it was 1933. All the people we mixed with in Germany were Polish and immigrants. So we didn't really have a German culture. I went to a Jewish school and all that sort of thing.
Once the war ended, you must have still been a schoolboy then.
The war ended in 1945 and I left school in 1945.
When did you arrive in Scotland?
28th of June 1939.
And you remember it very well?
No, I don't. I remember the arrival. I don't remember the date. I just happened to recently looked at a document which was stamped for the 28th of... Of course, we arrived a day earlier in London, but As far as arriving in Scotland, it was the 28th of June.
And how old were you then?
Just a few days short of 11.
Oh, so you're very young. How and why did you come to Scotland?
Because the people who were taking me into care were Scottish. Right. There was somebody in Berlin, my older sister, who may have been a teacher, I'm not sure the relationship, had connections in Scotland with groups of people. I think there were some Christians, in other words. They weren't Plymouth Brethren, but people like that.
Right.
And
right.
They took up individual children into their home.
And where exactly did you stay? Here in Glasgow, was it?
No, it was outside Clydebank. A place called Harpgate, not a terribly well-known place.
Not a lot of Jews there, I don't suppose.
In fact, there was one, I think, somewhere up the road, but no, there weren't any Jews, really.
So what was your impression of Scotland and the people? It must have been very strange for you.
No, absolutely, it wasn't all that strange. It wasn't all that strange. The people were very friendly. Father went to very accommodating. He had a boy of the same age as me. It must have been as strange for them as it was for me, because they were very ordinary, nice, ordinary, upper working class people. They worked in Singers and places like that when Singers was there. And to have a strange child, Jewish child, couldn't speak English, arrive in their midst, and they were very, I use the word ordinary, I don't mean that negatively, I just mean they had never explored the world the way people do nowadays. I think the idea of adventure was to go to Edinburgh for a day, you know, and it must have been very strange for them.
Of course. And did you find you picked up the language rapidly?
Yes, within about 6 weeks, I think.
Really? That's
no,
amazing.
That's what happens, not me. Mm. I'm not very good at languages. Mm. I went to a local school in Duntocher, and within 6 weeks, definitely, I could speak to the other children. And incidentally, just for the record, I had no problem there either. There was no bullying. They thought it was very strange, asked me funny questions. But it was a kind of exciting newcomer. So I found the transfer from Germany to Scotland fairly painless. Apart from, of course, missing my family and all the other things. But the reception and the welcome was very easy.
That's good. Did you meet or even mix with the local Jewish community, or were you?
There is no local Jewish community.
Oh no, but I mean with the wider Glasgow area?
No.
No.
Well, I don't know how to explain that. I stayed with these people till about May, June 1940, when the Germans finally got to invade the France and Holland and all that, and there's a certain doubt about German or strange children being around, I think. Also, the Jewish community here set up a hostel in Skelmorlie for local evacuees. And when that happened, the community, whatever they were, they collected as many of the Jewish children that had been living with non-Jewish families and sent them to Skelmorlie. So in about near the middle of 1940, we lived in a hostel, in a Jewish hostel. But it wasn't for refugees as such. It was for the local children from Glasgow, Jewish children.
I see. So, I was going to ask you about the refugee centre. That's not the refugee centre,
no,
separate.
That had nothing to do with the refugee centre. We were in Skelmorlie and then later in Castle Douglas. And of course, as the war progressed, the local children went back home, and what was left, the residue, was all kinder transportees. But it wasn't originally set up for that.
And you went to school there, did you?
Went to school in Castle Douglas. The rest of them went to Kirkcudbright and the older children. But I was back here in 1943 and then went to Highland.
And who were you staying with then?
My mother.
Oh, she had come out by that time?
Well, she had come out before the war, of course. But originally she was in Dorset in the South Coast with my older sister, as a domestic cook and nursery maid. And when the Germans finally got to the Channel ports, the authorities here thought that people of German origin were possible spies and might signal to the German submarines. So they had to leave Dorset and they came up to Glasgow.
Right, and so you were all together then?
Well, 1943, not the right thing, but 1943, most of us were sent away from Castle Douglas and came back to Glasgow. And those that had families, they were sent back to their families, and so I rejoined my mother and the other children, my brothers and sisters. Since I arrived in Britain, I never spoke German. First I lived with a family who couldn't speak German, and then went to the hostel. And by that time, he could speak English. And very rarely did somebody in the hostel speak German, almost unknown.
But when you lived with your mother, well, she spoke German to you and you answered in English.
Yeah, by that time, she
was the usual.
She started speaking English. And finally, we only spoke in English.
And was that a subconscious or a conscious decision? I know a lot of refugees who came at the same sort of time chose not to speak in the continental language that
again,
they
it's circumstantial. If you look at my record, everything is much of a circumstance. I didn't plan these things. In fact, the means came here, couldn't speak to anybody in German, didn't get together with my mother till from 39 to 43. So by that time, she was mostly speaking English, but she spoke a whole lot of languages, spoke Polish, Russian, Yiddish, German, and a bit of English, quite a lot of English. So she was quite a good English speaker by 1948-47. And I never spoke German again, very rarely. My sister, she came over and she went to people in Clydebank. My younger brother went to people in Kilmarnock. They were separated. Mm-hmm. And then we came together in a hostel in Stillwell. And my mother and my sister came back. Came up from Dorset where they were, and then my sister went to London. And the brother already in London.
You were five siblings who got to United.
Well, we weren't United for very long. My sister went to London almost right away.
And did you all come as part of the kinder transport?
No, I didn't. My mother went to, as a cook in a stately home. It was quite an experience for her, poor soul, because she had to disembowel deer and cooked venison and pork and things. I mean, that's something she wouldn't have physically touched. Never mind, was involved in cooking it. And my sister was there as a children's nurse. And I say we were there for something like nearly a year, 10 months or something. And then the serious war broke out. And they were told to leave. And they came to Glasgow. But my sister, very early after that, she went to live in London.
But your mother must have been very brave to allow her family to be displaced in all these directions.
Well, not quite this. Yes, I wish I could agree. It's not as simple as that. Mm. And so happens. My mother had a visa to go to the stately home, work in the stately home, with all the children on the visa.
Right.
But she didn't want to. Well, I think it was really my sister who didn't want to take that risk. So we were sent off. But we could have all gone with my mother. Mm-hmm. But my mother only came, my sister only came to Britain just a few weeks, a month or something before the war broke out. And that been fortuitous timing. Mm-hmm. If she hadn't had that, we'd all been trapped in Germany. And you can imagine what would happen then. Mm-hmm. So we're very lucky. But my sister, I think, was the main operator of this thought, rightly, I think, be safer to send the children away in case something vicious would actually happen.
She was about 17, 18, wasn't she? She sort of took control of the situation. And
very.
Well, my mother was too busy out here living. Yeah. She had five children and no husband.
So what risk, I'm not quite clear, what risk did she think would be run if you all went to Dorset with your mother?
No, in case the war broke out.
I see, so she wanted you out quicker. I see.
The older sister went down to London.
I already had a brother who was near London. He went down to a different system. Right. And young men became 17 and too old for the kinder transport. There was another arrangement to get them out of Germany. And my brother had that. And then with obviously the three young children, and they all went to the same different people. Then in 1943, we got together with my mother again, and I went to school in Glasgow, in England.
And so did your siblings, apart from the ones who were down in London, did they go to Highland as well?
But my sister did. My younger brother was too young for that. He went to school somewhere at George's Cross. And that's how we became a family again. But my brother, older brother and sister, didn't stay long. In the shadow. They wanted their freedom.
So how were you able to support yourself?
I wasn't. I stayed with my mother.
Right. And she found work in Scotland when came over?
Yeah. For a long time she worked in Geneva as a cook.
So within the Jewish community?
Well, she was more related to them because she was... My mother was living in the West End, and I wouldn't say that we had... We didn't have any strong connection. My mother's connection with the Jewish community would be in Janine's and, of course, joined the synagogue, but not on a social basis, really. My mother was there quite a long time and quite well known for her cooking. So she had a certain reputation there, one day. People came there to eat, not to stay in a hotel, but mostly to the restaurant. It was kosher, of course, and it was quite important to her.
And did your family start interacting with the local Jewish community?
Not very much. My mother was Orthodox, quite religious, and we had big battles about that she wanted me to do the right thing. And by the time I was about 14, I must admit I had lost all interest in religion or any belief in God. And we had quite a lot of difficulty there, but we lived always in the West End. So then she went to Garnet Hill Synagogue, and I did a bar mitzvah there. But after the bar mitzvah, I only went to my children's bar mitzvah, but I never went to synagogue. So I didn't have much contact with other Jewish people. But I had quite a lot of contact still with the residual kinder transportees who came back to Glasgow. The Jewish children who in different situations, some of them were living on their own, some living with other families, and so that was my, I think, the only real contact I had with ongoing Jewishness.
Did you go to university?
I didn't go to university, I went into apprenticeship with an architectural firm.
And was that chance, or did you know that's the direction you wanted your life to go in?
It was chance that I went to that particular firm. Although it was a very important chance, as far as. But I don't know why. The day I left school, almost literally, I decided I wanted to be an architect. Not that I knew what architects do. Still don't know what they do. But I just decided I wanted to be an architect. So, through family friend of us, no, I don't think it's necessary to give the whole story, but my best friend from the hostel, he had a connection through his aunt, his mother's cousin or something, through an architect called Jack Hoyer. And I said to him, ask her if he has room or wish to take on an apprentice. And he interviewed me and he said, come up on Monday and start. That was it. In the beginning.
Right, that was very lucky. But I'm sure he recognised that you were worth taking on.
Presumably. People write regularly. He discovered me because he didn't. But it's not the way things were done. 17-year-old boy isn't discovered. But people like that romantic story.
It's more romantic.
Better he discovered me than I discovered him.
Absolutely. And how did you meet your partner? When was that?
The partnership?
No, I think we're meeting your emotional partner.
You mean my wife?
Yes.
My wife.
We thought it was my wife.
Oh, we're not in the Jews. Not in the synagogue. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we met. When was that night? I've got to work it out. What, 44 years ago or something? Whatever that date is, what is that? 62.
Once you got the apprenticeship, you were with that partnership thereafter.
Forever.
Is that right? So some of these questions about was it hard to get work, did it make any difference that you were Jewish?
Not whatsoever.
Right, that's interesting.
It's funny. My boss was a Catholic, or meant to be a Catholic. He was actually of Italian origin. He wasn't much of a Catholic. He didn't like employing Catholics. because he thought they were being employed as a Catholic. That's complicated state of mind he was in. But he quite liked the idea of employing Jewish people.
And did he see that as a link to some of the architectural traditions of Europe?
If he did, he didn't tell me.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting.
So you stayed there for an apprenticeship for 5 years?
5 years.
And so where did you go after that?
I stayed on. It's unusual in those days. If you're an apprentice after 5 years, you usually moved on to another. But I stayed on. And by the middle of the 50s, me and my partner, future partner and a friend from the School of Architecture, had more or less taken over the running of the office. Although we weren't partners for quite a few years after that.
And so was that the norm then for people going into architecture that they would do an apprenticeship?
No.
Or
there were still quite a few apprentices then, but they were disappearing. And most, I would say by the time of 1955, everybody was going into universities, or schools of architecture. The schools of architecture had been into universities. But that's another story.
Going on that theme, do you think that the apprenticeship system produced a different sort of
architect? Different sort, or better.
Well, that's different sort.
That depends. I mean, I don't want to go into a great depth. It's not really the topic. But those have been into good offices. Offices that are willing to teach their apprentices. Of course, we went to day release too. Mm-hmm. We went to classes, afternoon and evening classes. We were doing the apprenticeship. But with those officers that were interested in the apprentices, I think produced good architects. And those that just used them as cheap labour, and cheap labour it was. When I started in 1945, it was 12 and 10 pence I got. And then the next year I got 22 and 10 pence.
That's quite a jump, actually.
Yes, and then 32 and 10 pence.
You couldn't live on that, could
you?
Within your architectural career, would you say that your European links made a difference to your vision? No.
I had no European links.
You didn't?
I left
you were too young.
I left Berlin when I was 11. And even I wouldn't claim I had such a degree of immaturity.
Well, obviously, from what you're saying, you really saw yourself as Scottish. Once you were here, is that right?
Well, that would be an exaggeration. I saw myself as Glaswegian. I'm British.
Right.
I still don't claim myself as Scottish.
Right.
I think it's a little bit arrogant to do so. But no, just me say it now before you ask me. I had no difficulties in my job or in my relationship with other students or in the professional level with my Jewishness or my foreignness. Never had any problem there. In fact, I think my exotic strangeness would probably have helped, but I have no problem, that's what I meant to say, because many people have an idea that somehow they had terrific difficulties they may have had. I'll just put it in perspective. The firm I was in with did a lot of church work, and I designed quite a few Roman Catholic churches, and had to deal with the bishop and the archbishops and the local priests, and there was never any problem.
Well, I suppose they saw you as not being one side or the other side.
Well,
was
I think
it easier
they saw me
in that
as
respect?
Being the Catholic Church, a great believer in making use of everybody for the furtherance of their religious ambitions. So I was just another wheel in the system. But it never, I had no difficulty at all. I just want to emphasize that. I had no doubt I was Jewish. They were well aware that I was Jewish. So just to say, while I am not religious at all, and I didn't mix, unfortunately, with Jewish people. I always revealed I was Jewish. I mean, I don't get me wrong, I didn't say I'm Jewish.
Mm.
But there was never any effort to hide my Jewishness from anybody. In fact, we had a good drinking time with priests and things. And it was always recognized that I was not only not Catholic, but not religious.
So, career-wise, what would you say were the highlights in architectural commissions? Which ones stand out for you? Because you said you were involved in churches.
Well, when you first went there, there was no work, harder work was like, because it was just post-war. But once we started again, about 1950, 51, we did churches. And but by 1950, Jack Coyle was a church architect in a way. But they came to the middle of the 50s, and Andy McMillan, and I took it over more or less. Pretty well, a freehand. Well, you must understand how it happens. I mean, people often ask me that question. And people wouldn't come to you if they didn't want you. Architects are public. I mean, the work they do is public. If somebody wants to go to look at, know what kind of buildings I do, or work we did, you can do that. Mm-hmm. It's a accessible examples of your work are always available. So if a priest comes to you, or the bishop comes to you and wants you to design, he knows what kind of architect you are. So they're self-regulating in a way. So, no, we had no problem. Occasionally, if you have an argument with a client, it was always amicable and very interesting, in fact.
Do you see yourself as following a particular trend in Scottish architecture? Or
take away the word Scottish.
In general, in world, European?
Modern architecture. Well, more or less European. Modern architecture. I would call it modified modern. I mean, it's not trying to get away from modern architecture. Mm. It's to enrich it with some things that the earlier moderns had abandoned. In the meantime, I think. But it's a long story. I taught in the School of Architecture.
Oh, sorry, in the School of Art.
No, at the School of Art.
Right.
They were then connected at that time with the university. Because the university gave degrees, because the art school wasn't able to give degrees. But I taught in the art school on a part-time basis.
When did you start teaching?
About 1970. Till about 3 years ago. On a part-time basis. Design, teaching design, tutoring students, lecturing. And I've been out for, what, how many years? From 70 to about 97 or something.
And so what was the last commission that you were involved in? Can you remember?
Depends what you mean by last commission. The last important commission was a college in Cambridge, a new college in Cambridge, Robinson College. That was our last important work. After that, they collapsed it from. Because work was difficult to get. It's like now, not quite as bad as now, but almost as bad. Almost all our work had to do somewhere with the welfare state and the church. Mm-hmm. So we did schools, hospitals, colleges, and when that stopped, which it did, mm-hmm. our workload disappeared. Because we had never any real reputation in industrial or commercial work, which was the big thing after about 1980 or so. So we couldn't find any more clients. And the McMillan, who was my business partner, he went to run the school, the Glass McIntosh School of Architecture. And at one stage, I got a chair in Edinburgh in 1984, the chair of architecture at the university, Edinburgh, not Glasgow.
And does Edinburgh tend to have a different style, would you say? Or does it just depend who's teaching within the schools?
Well, no, that's fair. It depends on the relationship, in my view, it's my favourite topic of conversation, the relationship between the School of Architecture and its university.
Right.
Until, what was it about, I'm not sure the exact date, but in the 60s sometime, well, in the late 50s, it was decided that all schools of architecture who had previously had to be freestanding or been attached to art schools or to technical colleges, and some of them to universities, should all go into universities.
And do you think that's limited them?
It's very much so. I think it's the worst place in the world for schools of architecture being universities for all kinds of reasons. One of them because universities are not too interested in vocational subjects, and also because the university architecture is also controlled by the RBA and other bodies, and there's a conflict there between the autonomy of the university. Anyway, university is not a good place for architects. Architecture, I should say. Talking about it would take a couple of days to discuss this issue. So I've moved to Edinburgh. Ideally, I went to Edinburgh, I think, because one, we didn't have much work or any work, and two, I really felt that I could make some contribution to a very moribund school, because in these universities, especially Edinburgh, nobody ever leaves. The staff stay on forever. There's nobody else will have them.
Yeah.
And I thought that might make a difference. It didn't work out that way. I was very unwelcome by the staff. So I left after 7 years.
So why was that? Was that because you were from Glasgow?
Partly from Glasgow, and partly the Monday school, with a great autonomy of the staff. I don't think anybody ever told them what to do, or checked on their work. And I decided they did look at what they're doing. And I think that's one of the areas of difficulty, because they just wouldn't. But they didn't want my leadership, that's for sure. They've been quite happy running their own classes on their own way, and if somebody came in to try and get involved, they were very less than happy about this.
And was or the whole idea of modernism part of the problem there?
No, absolutely no. Well, I don't think so. Obviously, there are people who didn't believe in modernism, but by 1980, middle 80s, that was a debate that was more or less over. Still, there's still residual people who believed in, I'll call it neoclassicism, call it what you like, or what you call Scottish architecture. But that wasn't the issue. It wasn't an issue with architecture or design. It was a Bishop Hotterhouse School of Architecture. And if you want to make changes, I mean, first, after, I would say, 3 weeks, then you had made a mistake. I stayed on for 7 years. But the first thing I was told, when I wanted to make some changes, this is a democratic school, so you have no, you know. Secondly, they said, when I first realized I'd made a mistake, when I referred to it as a school of architecture, which we did in Glasgow and most schools, they said, this is not a school of architecture. It's a department of architecture of the University of Edinburgh. So the interest was more in relation to the university than teaching architecture. So this didn't work for me. But in the meantime, of course, I didn't just teach, but I was also on various visiting boards to other schools of architecture. I was also on the RIB panel, and I was an external examiner to a lot of schools and things. So I have quite a long experience and involvement in teaching. In fact, last year, Andy McMillan and myself got an award, a financial award, which was very nice, for the best teachers of that year.
That's great.
Or ever, no matter. So, not boastful about it. It's not too difficult to be the best teacher. But the point I'm making is my involvement in teaching is not only extensive, but over a long period of time. We built a significant number of churches, built a seminary at Cowboys, we built quite a few schools and colleges, built student residences in Hull. We built, as I said, a major new college in Cambridge, and it worked quite a lot for Wadham College in Oxford. So we had a sort of national reputation. And the same, and worked out of Glasgow. But while I was doing all this, I had other fingers in pies. I was, for 11 years, I was on the Scottish Fine Art Commission. And for 5 years, I was with the Scottish Arts Council. And various other things I did. So I'm just mentioning that, because well integrated into the the establishment, we'll call it.
Yes, I was thinking about that when you were speaking. You really moved completely away from the Jewish community, didn't you?
They're not interested in architecture. I mean, in our office we had two or three Jewish apprentices or assistants. I don't know what happened to most of them, but almost most of them didn't go and be architects, because their parents didn't approve of being architects. Jewish people don't want architects.
Why do you think that is?
Because they don't think it's safe enough job. I mean, a lot of them want to be artists, the children of it. And parents wouldn't stand for it, so they said, oh, I'll be an architect. Well, they just about got away with that. But there's no doubt we are the same. Two or three Jewish young people in the office. And well, they were usually against the approval of their parents. Because it's not a secure job. You have to be a dentist or a doctor or a lawyer if you're Jewish. So that's part of my disconnection. It's not a deliberate effort. It's just, there's no common ground, to be quite honest. There was one Jewish architect in Glasgow, quite well known, called Baron Berkert. But he was very commercial, money-making architect. We were money-making architects. And as I said, I didn't move away from them. I was never with them. I mean, my experience, incidentally, and my understanding is the Jewish community weren't all that happy to have all these refugees coming to Glasgow.
They wanted
the sleeping dogs to keep lying.
Well, that seems to be traditional, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fear of too many foreign people.
The mining community you know what I mean? I don't want to go into that. It's not a pleasant subject. Mm. But definitely. I mean, in terms of taking children overseas, as refugees, I should say, the Jewish community didn't make a great contribution to that. Almost all the people you met as kinder transporters went to non-Jewish families. I have no statistics, but I don't know many people went to Jewish families.
I think a lot of them were just beginning to settle and didn't want to disturb
the
equilibrium.
Oh, no, I don't necessarily blame them, but it's a characteristic of the existing established community. So, but with me, it's to do with my job, to be living in the West End, my non-interest in religious Jewishness. If somebody asks me what I am, I say, well, I'm a secular Jew, or I'm an ethnic Jew, and I make no attempt to hide that. In fact, I'm rather quite pleased to be Jewish, but it doesn't mean for me to go to synagogue and mix with it.
But it's interesting that you said that your children still had a bar mitzvah.
Yeah,
I think it does sort of depend quite often.
Yeah, there's no harm attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not blaming anybody. I want them to feel Jewish, but I have no demand on them from a religious point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I think, to extend the discussion a little bit, a Jew needs to have some reason for being Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, being treated as a Jew, I mean, whether negatively or positively. So you need to give them some backbone for that special relationship you have. Well, I've said I have no problem being Jewish. There's never any doubt that my Jewishness was a factor in the relationship with non-Jewish people. Not to say that's necessarily negative, but you cannot be a Jew without being outed. Even my best friends have always know that I'm Jewish, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They make remarks or give special attention to it. But that doesn't bother me. I'm quite happy about that.
So how did you actually meet, now that we know, wife rather than partner? We just thought we'd be correct.
So I don't mind. But according to my rabbi, we're not properly married, so it doesn't matter.
That's more exciting. So tell us anyway.
It was a put-up job, actually. I discovered later. I was introduced. I was invited to a cocktail party, and Danny was invited to the party with the ulterior motive that we would meet, and we did.
That's very romantic.
Very romantic.
That was Gertrude Bedtime, who died about two months ago.
You don't know Gertrude?
She was a friend of my mother's, and
right.
She invited me to this cocktail party in order to meet her.
That's very nice.
So
You're not from Glasgow, Virginia.
No, I was born in France.
Right.
I came here in 1953 with my parents.
So we're from...
My mother was from Vienna, my father was from Germany.
Right.
He had died, my mother remarried, also somebody from Germany. But
he got a job here after the war, she was a refugee.
So how did you end up in Glasgow?
My stepfather got a job in Motherwell.
By
a French company who then collapsed and we stayed.
And obviously, I mean, Motherwell is just like France, with a slightly different accent.
Yeah, just like France, especially.
So that's interesting when you were saying about, so with your children, did you decide to talk to them in English then?
Always. We go to Berlin, which I do, we did every year with my students. They all bloody well speak English.
When you go to Berlin, what aspects are you looking at in architecture?
Mostly for the students, yeah. Housing. German housing mm-hmm. has been a succession of contradictory ideas in the Victorian equivalent, mm-hmm. or the late Georgian equivalent. They had a particular type of building, and then it was then built a housing block, which is unusual. It's series of courtyards. It's quite famous in Berlin housing.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Barracks, mm-hmm. and they were pretty low standard. But I think compared to what it was previously, mm-hmm. like Glasgow, tenements were great improvements of what happened in the early 18th century. Very same in Berlin. All the standards of the tenement housing was much better here than the Berlin housing, where the outside room on the street was occupied by middle class farmers. As you got deeper into the block, it was working class and poverty stricken people. And that was a characteristic of that housing. And then there was other housing. Germans, Berliners, having a succession of experimental housing exhibitions. So every one of these was a reversal of the previous one. You know, the next one was like sort of Siemensstadt, where the Siemens, big industrialist, mm. built housing, which was more or less like tenements, but un-urban in a way. I mean, unlike Glasgow, where the tenements are in a very urban structure. And then they had various these things. But each one of them was a denial of the previous attempt at ideal housing. That makes a good examples for students to look at these different ways of attempting to deal with the housing problem.
It's interesting you say they all aspired to the ideal tenement block, did they?
Well, not only tenement block, but I say ultimately, yes, I mean, my own view is, but for what it's worth, is that when people look at all kinds of housing ideas, leaving aside the garden city and that sort of thing, and a city dwelling, a dense urban pattern, always comes back to a tenement-like thing.
You can get more in a smaller area. Yeah.
So Berlin was a very good place to take students studying that kind of housing development.
So we were wondering if, you know, looking back over your long life, from your experiences here, both in career and in your personal life, what would you say were the highs and lows of all these coincidences that have made up your life?
Well, obviously, I have to say that the high of my life was my architectural career, which, shall we say, it's high points. I mean, recently, a few years ago, a couple of years ago, when the office stopped, we gave our archive to the Glasgow School of Art. And it's a significant archive, not because it's such good work, some of it's good work and some isn't. Well, most of it's good dish. Because our office was in practice, stopped practice just when practice changed drastically, when computers became important. All our drawings are hand-made drawings, and we gave them the whole office with all our files and whatnot to see. That's what an office in 1945 was like. I don't know what they've done with it. But anyway, as a result of that, they had an exhibition in the lighthouse of our office work from 1956 onwards, when we took over the property of the office. And that was probably, I would say, it summed up mm-hmm. for the first time our significant contribution. I mean, we had lots of awards, but IRB awards and Civic Trust awards. But Andy McGuire and I were, well, we still are well-known figures in the architectural profession of the whole country, not just in Scotland, and recognised as such. So, obviously, my architectural career from onwards of 56 to about, I would say, middle 80s, were the time of my life, enjoyable time. architecture is a great profession if you've got work and you've got understanding clients, and you don't need to want to make a lot of money. But yes, it was good. Very good.
And Danny, you're not, did you have a different profession? Because obviously you're not, you weren't in architecture.
No. I run a shop and trade.
Which is very important.
Which is very important.
Without trade, you don't manage.
Yes. People like you pay for architects, I would think, in the end.
Yeah. So you're also meant to say another high of your life was obviously meeting Danny as well.
That's my social life. Yes, it was. And a very nice family.
But I suppose I went to Glasgow University and I was in the Jewish Student Society, mm-hmm. so I actually know a lot more of the Scottish Jewish people in Isidore.
Right.
So that
right.
connection. That's...
But do you think living in the West End, it's a different world anyway? There's sort of two Jewish communities, aren't there? And
I think so.
Very few
I
in the West
so.
End.
But I suppose most of our friends were refugees as well. But they've died off, quite a few. So.
It's interesting that because even though you say that you integrated, there is something that brings people with similar experiences together, isn't
oh,
there?
Oh, yes. I say I'm not shy away from that, but limited interest. Mm-hmm. I'm not nostalgic about Berlin. I mean, you hang out and label onto you at the kinder transport, mm-hmm. I object to that. A wee label saying Berlin or whatnot. It's just important to me that I was out of Berlin, or for that matter. I don't know any people here whom I knew in Germany.
But culturally, you feel very Jewish and you're very comfortable with people
I'm comfortable
who
being,
are like you.
I mean, the people I know in Berlin, there's quite a lot, they're young people. Or young by me, they were students, because I got my students to live with them, because cheap in the trips and all that. So I met quite a few young Germans, and they're very, shall we say, interested in what happened, and very angry with their parents for either being involved or not talking about it, because the Germans, the older Germans, don't talk about it. And these young people have never stopped questioning me about what happened and and what, so they're very good Jews, pro-Semitic. And I think that's quite genuine and sincere. But the parents would never talk about what happened to the Jews or what happened to them. So it was quite interesting for me, the amount of interest it took in the wartime or the pre-war period.
That's interesting. They, of course, didn't experience the horrors of the war in Versailles and all the things that were blamed on Jews, and I think it must have been quite hard to rise above that at the time.
I'm not sure it's not that hard, but I mean, I can't... it's, the phenomenon of anti-Semitism is too baffling. Why the Jews are picked up to be blamed for something, I have no idea. But even here they're blamed for it. I don't mean, and every time there's a Jewish person involved, they always tell you he's a Lithuanian Jew, he's a German Jew, he's a, and not necessarily hostile, it just trips off the tongue very easily. So it's difficult to understand this phenomenon. I don't think I've been thinking about it for my whole life, but I still don't get it.
You know, why are we of such interest?
I don't understand it. I mean, I say anybody who recognizes you as being Jewish in dealing with you is an anti-Semite, even though he's a friend. There's always this feeling that being Jewish is something special and different. I mean, you know, it's very odd. Even my best friends aren't anti-Semites, I assure you, but they still have this feeling they're dealing with something very exotic, which they think they're very brave to. To take as equals, I think. They don't say that, of course. And I say, I want to emphasize, I've had no overt anti-Semitism addressed to me.